7:71. Both teams off tonight, and the Blackhawks host Florida. The forecast, cloudy and windy, seasonal temperatures, 50-50 chance of some light snow. High today, 29. Right now, 11 in Racine, 10 in Kenosha, 8 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind from the southwest at 24, gusting to 33 miles per hour. Wind chill 10 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's. 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very excited to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events. Just ahead of our conversation, we want to remind you, as if you didn't know, that today is day number one of the newest pledge drive for Wisconsin Public Radio. And these are critical times in which your support for Wisconsin Public Radio and WGTD is especially crucial. So we would appreciate it if you would take a moment, and feel free to even do so during the course of the morning show, either by going online to WPR.org or by calling toll-free 1-800-383-9772, 1-800-383-9772, and pledge whatever amount you can afford in support of Wisconsin Public Radio. And when you do so, please indicate in whatever measure you can that you are a listener to WGTD, and even better, if you happen to be a listener to the morning show. Your support matters, and your interest in what we do here at WGTD is very important as well. So thank you for taking the time to express your interest and support of WGTD and Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a pleasure to once again sit across the table from Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clawson Center and author of After the Cold War. Dr. Sear joins us on a monthly basis to offer his thoughts on events here and abroad. And as usual, there is no shortage of important and critical things to be talking about. So, Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the program.
Thank you, Greg. The feeling's mutual.
I know that one of the things that's really fun about reading your blog is that not only are you talking about matters of the moment, but in many cases, as you analyze events in the current headlines, they will evoke really interesting reflections on sometimes the relatively distant past in a way that doesn't always happen. I mean, that, you know, when talking about our Great Recession, we're suddenly hearing about Martin Van Buren or something like that. I mean, that there are lessons to be learned from our own history, and a lot of pundits don't pay enough attention to history. So, and I was really reminded of that as I was reading through your most recent columns, and in particular, a really interesting story you told in a column that at least the headline I saw was Politics and Money, a Lesson from Ronald Reagan. And this is, in a sense, a cautionary tale, perhaps, for some of the Republicans who are vying to be the next Republican candidate for president. I wonder if you could share that really interesting story with our listeners.
Okay, I really wanted to talk about Martin Van Buren, but if you insist, we can talk about Ronald Reagan.
Young Van Buren a little later, yeah.
Okay. I worked at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations for 20 years, and the Illinois primary used to be more pivotal, at least potentially. Super Tuesday, the big primary sweep, came in the 80s, and has since overshadowed Illinois. But we would work very hard before that to get presidential candidates. In 1980, a good lesson for today, an awful lot of the media focus on the Democratic side was on Ted Kennedy, who was challenging Jimmy Carter and was way ahead of him in the polls for a time, until Senator Kennedy declared, at which point the support nosedived. And John Connally, who had been a Democrat, was wounded when President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas in 1963. He later became a Republican, Nixon Secretary of the Treasury, and raised an enormous amount of money as a Republican contender in 1980. We had lined up Connally, George H.W. Bush, and Ronald Reagan for separate public events in Chicago. Connally raised over $20 million, an unprecedented sum
back then,
35 years ago. He got almost no votes. He picked up one delegate, a lady from Arkansas, as I recall, who was known as the $20 million delegate. He spent about $11 million before he dropped out, which was fine with us because he wasn't drawing a crowd. He dropped out just before the Chicago speech. We used our corporate list finally. He was very much the Pied Piper for CEOs of that time, including Bob Stewart, a very fine man whose family ran Quaker Oats for literally generations. Stewart eventually became Reagan's ambassador to Norway, but the head of Quaker Oats, FMC, Sara Lee, Continental Bank, on and on and on. Connally wasn't getting any votes, but he really was lining up the corporate crowd. He'd been with us earlier in the year to talk to our Chicago committee, essentially a business group, and his ability to relate, they were all older white men at that time, there was a sort of natural bond and symbiosis with that population. A light bulb went on over my head when he dropped out. Corporate income was increasingly important to our program growth. We kept our budget balanced and growing in real terms, but it was not easy to do in that era of high inflation. I thought, why don't we organize a corporate reception, because the CEOs are wandering leaderless like the Hebrews without Moses, you know, in a kind of wilderness.
With Connally having dropped out of
exactly,
the race.
Exactly, yeah. And Bush said yes right away, and Reagan turned us down flat. We gathered about 15 chairmen, CEOs, and other senior executives to meet with Bush, who's one of the most impressive people I've ever been around in person. The same qualities that seemed frantic on television were extremely dynamic in person. And quite apart from being a presidential candidate, he was the center of gravity in that room, a very smart, naturally, extraordinarily smart, naturally authoritative person. The Reagan people said that the former governor and Nancy Reagan wanted to have a small private lunch with John Riley, the president of the council, my boss, as well as friend, and me. They wanted to do a press conference with the governor, his speech, and that was it. It was a remarkably paced schedule for usually the supercharged, overscheduled presidential types. Right.
And no reception with these high-roller CEOs.
No, as I said, they turned it down flat. It was actually a pretty genial conversation with Reagan. He really seemed like a regular guy writ large. He was so authentic and approachable that I asked him about this reception, and to my surprise, it was not a staff decision. He was very much aware of it and made very clear that that would have been an unwise move. He said, in effect, well, Mr. Sear, if you want to become president of the United States, you have to convince the average worker, the average woman and man struggling to make a living in this country, that you understand their life and what they're facing, because they elect presidents. And if you do what John Connally does, Riley had quoted LBJ. He'd worked in the Johnson White House because he was Hubert Humphrey's foreign policy assistant. LBJ is saying that his friend John Connally was one of the smartest, one of the toughest, and one of the meanest men I've ever met. But John's problem is he can't talk to any fellow who's not wearing a couple $1,000 suit, which was quite perceptive in hindsight. Anyway, Reagan said, if you do what Connally did, which is constantly photographed in corporate boardrooms and Lear jets and country clubs, with the corporate rich and famous, they're not going to vote for you, which, of course, is what happened. And then Reagan continued to say, besides, I don't have to cultivate them. They're coming to me. I'm winning primaries. I'm going to be the Republican nominee. That's increasingly clear. I don't have to spend time cultivating them. They're increasingly seeking me out. They have no choice. President Carter, they're quite alienated from him. Ted Kennedy, get serious. There's nobody but me. And it slowly dawned on me, since he was explaining the situation so clearly in words that even a PhD could understand, that he was an extremely shrewd superior to Bush in the context of how you appeal to people in our time and how you get elected president.
Yeah, and
I'm glad you asked. It's a good lesson for me.
Well, and a good lesson for a lot of people interested in politics and in this day and age, and in particular in an age where this divide between rich and poor is widening ever more dramatically. And there is, on the one hand, this sense that there are a few extremely rich people in this country who have gigantic influence because they're so rich and because they're so aggressive using their wealth. But that, on the other hand, the dollars are not the same as votes, and that ultimately it still comes down to who you can appeal to. And, of course, it takes money to get your message out and so on. But I mean, it also helps kind of put that whole concern in context, it seems to me.
Yeah, enormously rich people have influence, but they don't. And people who get elected president, with few exceptions, in one way or another, are able to appeal to a mass population. That's true of President Obama, certainly of George W. Bush, who, it's not an original statement, hadn't had the common touch more than his dad. I do think his father was considerably more successful, not just as a dad, which is always important, but as a chief executive. And certainly Bill Clinton, whom I credit with returning the Democratic Party to electability after some years in the electoral wilderness, starting with Reagan.
a great, great story. I was really glad to read it and found it to be so interesting.
I'm glad I finally said something you found interesting.
Yeah, you did. Let's turn to, speaking of interesting, one of the most interesting of developments, and quite a recent one, although it is coming in the wake of long negotiations over the course of many years, is the promise, perhaps, of some kind of nuclear deal between the United States and Iran, and the fact that it is a exceedingly delicate situation on a couple of different fronts. Not only what we're trying to broker with Iran, but the Obama administration trying to keep the Congress from making certain moves towards more sanctions, and Israel's reaction to all of this. I mean, it would be complicated enough, but this situation feels even especially complicated. Tell us what you think about this recent development, and maybe one of the questions is just how promising are these developments? I mean, how hopeful should we be?
Well, it's very high stakes. I do think there will be an agreement. I think the Iranians are drawing it out as long as possible. I am a great admirer of John Kerry as Secretary of State. I continue to be flabbergasted, not just impressed, by the physical energy he must have to devote himself so relentlessly to extremely demanding travel alone, as well as complicated negotiations of a very, very important sort. The stakes are very high in this case and others, with extremely difficult as well as effective people. Well, I think we're very well served by the current Secretary of State. I do think Iran has a very powerful interest in eventually reaching an accord. I also think they have an interest in drawing things out as long as possible. As you indicate, it's complicated in various political contexts. I believe next week is when Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is going to make his famous, notorious, extremely important address to the U.S. Congress over the objections of the U.S. executive. I think that's very unfortunate. I don't think it will help him in the upcoming Israeli election, although I'm just an academic on the sidelines. But it's a very complicated mix and has already highlighted the inevitable gulf between the legislature and the executive in this country.
Hmm. How would you characterize the history of our relations with Iran over the last several decades? I mean, I suppose going all the way back to the hostage crisis at the end of Carter's term, just as Reagan was, of course, taking office when finally the hostages were released. But I mean, since then, what has the state of affairs, generally speaking, been between our two nations? Has it been nothing but frost and then only very, very gradually thawing, or has there been more ebb and flow between our two nations? Just how complex is that history itself?
Well, there's been a very long-term standoff, as you indicate, and each side, I think we've been guilty of demonizing them to a degree. We're very useful to Iran, as we are to other governments in Cuba and Venezuela and Russia, as the external enemy that you can highlight to distract people from your own problems. Hmm. Our history with Iran dates back to a degree to World War II, but certainly to the very beginning of the Cold War, well before the 79 hostage crisis. The Soviet Union did, I believe, occupy part of Iran right at the end of the Second World War, and they withdrew, as they did from other territories in Europe that went beyond the diplomatic agreements that Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt had reached during the war. But the fact that the Truman administration, I believe, was rather bellicose in threatening the Soviets if they did not withdraw certainly contributed to Cold War tensions. Hmm. We, meaning the CIA, overthrew the government of Iran and put in place the Shah. The Shah's father, I believe, had been involved very directly in killing the father of the Ayatollah. So we intervened in a very intense literal blood feud in Iran, which is all important prelude to the Shah being thrown out by a revolution in 79. I think Eisenhower and Allen Dulles and the others were right in the context of the Cold War to support the Shah so strongly, because he was a useful stabilizer and modernizer, as ugly and corrupt as that regime was during very difficult years. But with that history, when the Ayatollah Khomeini returned in 79 very dramatically in the midst of the Iran hostage crisis, that was made to order for difficult relations between the two countries.
Hmm. As I mentioned, one of the challenges we've been reading about is that there seems to be mounting pressure on Capitol Hill for stepped-up sanctions against Iran. Mm-hmm. And, of course, were those sanctions to be put in place, that could really upset this delicate situation and this treaty being brokered so cautiously and carefully. And it's one of just a number of issues right now in terms of tensions between the White House and this ever more Republican Congress with which the Obama administration is dealing. How do you see that situation right now?
Oh, I think it's a great complication. It's not surprising, given the power of the very important, in some ways unique, positive alliance between the U.S. and Israel, and what has been, in my view, accurately described as a very powerful Israel lobby in Washington. This is another act of a continuing drama. Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, I believe, Mark Kirk from right next door, Republican in Illinois, were principal sponsors of legislation to ramp up sanctions last year. The Democrats, of course, had the Senate. The White House strongly opposed, I believe rightly opposed, that legislation. And it didn't get brought to a vote with the Republicans in control of the Senate. And Netanyahu and associates desperately trying to mobilize as much legislative support as they can in order to benefit him and Israeli in the upcoming Israeli election. It's a lot more high stakes than it was. It's very unfortunate, but it's part of American politics. Historically, right. Congress, on sensitive topics especially, has tried to, on important matters, assert authority over the executive. It's extremely unwise, but it's something that happens. And this is the latest act coming up. Latest act coming up in a particularly high-stakes drama.
Right. Speaking of high-stakes drama, there's also the matter of this budgetary standoff involving Homeland Security and its budget and immigration and so on. And I think the deadline looming in terms of funding for the Homeland Security Department expiring on Friday.
Yeah, that's right.
So unless some kind of stopgap measure is concocted before then, that's a very ominous situation as well. Or is this just people playing politics?
I think it's people playing politics. I learned, I believe, thanks to NPR, that the last time we had a government shutdown, about at least 80%, probably more, of the Homeland Security employees came to work because they were deemed as, quote, essential employees, unquote. It is a case showing, in contemporary terms, presidential appeal to the public at large. Obama has, I think, outmaneuvered the Republicans, especially the House Republican leadership, in the sense that he can position himself and is as standing for defense of Homeland Security, while these Republicans are in fact weakening our position vis-a-vis the terrorists, all of which is very melodramatic. I think that has understandable public appeal given our understandable preoccupation with Islamic terrorism today. The White House is benefiting from this particular standoff. I don't believe in reality we are suddenly this Friday going to become more vulnerable to terrorist attacks. I don't minimize their importance, but it's a good case of example of a very skillful politician in the White House outmaneuvering a much more diffuse, much harder to control legislative opposition. Hmm. It's another good reason why the executive should be in charge of foreign policy.
One of the most vexing issues that confronts us right now is what in the world to do about ISIS. And this is a threat that seems ever more potent in some respects, although my understanding is that one of the complications about it is just what is this organization and just how tight an organization is it, and when you see sort of outcroppings of it in other places, to what extent are they really associated, allied with ISIS, and where is the head of this Hydra that we're trying to attack in some kind of way? President Obama has been criticized a fair amount for his kind of shifting policies on ISIS. I suspect you're going to tell us there aren't any simple solutions to this.
No, but it is a simple conflict. This organization is so extreme and so viciously violent, and in that sense self-destructive and probably eventually suicidal, that they've established a tremendous broad coalition against them, including Sunni and Shiite fighters working together in a very comprehensive sustained combat operation. This is an area where body counts have some significance. The number of the enemy you kill, it's important not to make that your only measuring tool of progress or failure. Reliable intelligence reports in the serious public media indicate that there is an estimated 18,000 or so of these men and some women, the most fanatical of the fanatics. Military combat operations in January killed at least 6,000 of them. It's an area where they don't seem to be doing very well. I think their extreme and pretty insane approach to military operations is reflected in their lack of success in terms of generating, at least so far, broad public support and their ability to handle a major offensive and combined arms, essentially international offensive against them.
The question remains of what America should do in terms of, do we put boots on the ground? Do we drop bombs? Where do we drop them? I mean, I think one of the things you're saying, though, is, you know, for as difficult as some of those choices are, the fact is that there is such widespread opposition to ISIS, even from unlikely quarters, that is one way in which this is a simpler fight to wage than maybe some other fights where we have to choose our targets very, very carefully for fear of displeasing certain other forces. It doesn't sound like that's quite the concern when you're talking about something as sort of demonic as ISIS.
Well, I do think the president should stop talking about how we're not going to put boots on the ground, partly because it's not true. We have a now substantially growing force of advisors, which the Obama White House has reluctantly acceded to in that region. It tends to underscore a division between us and our allies. We'll let them do the dirty work on the ground while we use air power. It's understandable, again, for domestic political reasons, but it's not good foreign policy, in my opinion.
Speaking of that part of the world, you wrote recently about a recent visit, I think it was actually in late January, from British Prime Minister David Cameron. And one of the primary concerns in that piece, which was mostly about the U.S. and Britain's very close relationship, is the complication of Iran. Mm-hmm. What kind of role has Britain played in our relationship with Iran and the brokering of this new potential agreement?
I think they play inevitably an extremely important role, especially with us, and essentially a very positive one. They have an historical and imperial history in that part of the world that we don't. McGeorge Bundy, JFK's national security advisor, used to like to say that the British provide us with someone to talk to. And indeed, in that era, Kennedy had his own vexing problems with Europe, and he had far more difficulties than developed during the Eisenhower administration. And Britain Harold Macmillan, the prime minister, that was the one European leader who really liked and was personally fond of President Kennedy, and also counseled him continually in ways that were beneficial in terms of always challenging transatlantic relations. So they are someone to talk to. Cameron talked to the Congress, in great contrast to Netanyahu or just about anybody else in the world. He didn't make a formal address, but he was lobbying the Senate, and there was no objection. That's how close our relationship is. I can't think of any other foreign head of government who could come to Washington and start lobbying the Congress or any other significant interest group and not have people raising hell, especially from the other political party. It's one of the beneficial consequences of our alliance forged in the Second World War, the special relationship, and specifically Winston Churchill. The British government, starting before the war began, and especially during the darkest days, the first few years from 39 to 42, they, in a very sustained and disciplined way, developed a public relations offensive to develop positive sentiment in the U.S. at a time when about 90% of the population was isolationist before Pearl Harbor and the spring of 42 when things changed. And Winston himself was marketed to the Americans. It's fascinating to read the history of that time. Another very authentic figure, the Winston Churchill that was marketed, was the real guy, just like with Ronald Reagan. You see, in a real sense, you got what appeared on stage. But it was a very calculated effort. And that's the foundation for this. I was surprised, and I'm very much an Anglophile, I think, that Cameron could come over and do that at the request of the White House, in this case, unlike the Israeli situation. But nobody complained. There's usually some old guy, the lingering isolationists are all gone, and with the British especially, there are no problems.
Right. It shows how close we are to them.
Yeah, and it's the right kind of ally to have, I must say. You know, they did run the world for a couple of hundred years, and in hindsight, in the context of the time, not so bad.
I'm reminded of the anniversary that was celebrated just last year, or 2 years ago, I forget now, but of that famous picnic at Hyde Park. When the King of England and his wife were brought over, and
by FDR,
right?
Yeah, I was thinking of Hyde Park in London.
And charmed the American public, and again, a lot of calculations went into that visit, into serving a very down home picnic on the grounds of Hyde Park to make the King and Queen seem like approachable, likable people, which to a large extent they were. It's interesting to contemplate how significant that forging of the friendship 75 years ago, how crucial that is to it sustaining so strongly all these years later.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that it was so carefully forged then.
Right. George VI and the Queen came over at the invitation of FDR, and there were lots of positive photo ops. It was part of Roosevelt's very calculated effort after he and associates became convinced that Nazi Germany really was, in effect, a global threat and that the British should be supported. It was part of a very, very carefully designed American effort to support the British. A particularly good example of the complexities of executive leadership at the top, because Roosevelt was saying one thing and doing another. In terms of involvement in the war, and in hindsight, he was right. Just standing up and consistently saying publicly in clear and simple terms the right thing to do often is not the way to be successful in terms of the real world.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show, as I do once a month, with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clawson Center at Carthage College, and Clawson, a distinguished professor of world business and political economy. You wrote again recently, it was no surprise, about one of the world leaders you most admire, Chancellor Merkel from Germany.
You were
writing specifically about the very important role which Germany is playing, not only in the continuing tensions between Russia and Ukraine, but also the very important role which they are playing in trying to handle the Greek problem, the economic woes of Greece, which would, at least to some extent, seem to pose a threat to the stability of the European Union. Just say a word about Chancellor Merkel and why you find her to be such an exceptionally effective figure. I mean, what kind of challenges is she facing, and in what way is she facing them so very, very well?
She is, first of all, a very durable figure, especially given the particular history of her country, her positive and rational and law-abiding leadership, I think, is extraordinarily impressive. Speaking of the past, there are very powerful nationalist right sentiments in Germany, especially in her CDU-CSU, the national, more conservative party. She's been able to work with the SPD, the Social Democrats, in broad coalition efforts that have been changing but have been durable and very stable in Germany. She's also kept a lid on the far left, but I think the far right is by far the greater threat in terms of instability. Mm-hmm. And she's been able to manage the broad European Union coalition, imposing fiscal discipline, relative discipline, not just on Greece, which is a very small economy. I wrote in an op-ed a few years ago that Apple Corporation, and probably others now, but Apple had more capital available than the Greek economy. It is a very small economy, but Italy, Spain, even Portugal are not. And German leadership in terms of maintaining cohesion and maintaining the common currency, kind of against history. Currency unions don't work very well. This one has for a while. Most of the members of the European Union do, except the euro, including the major countries, except for Britain. The ability to juggle all these different things I find quite impressive. I also wrote an op-ed, probably the one you're referring to, complimenting her with President Hollande of France getting the ceasefire in the Ukraine. Now, that has since fallen apart. But I do believe that diplomatic effort should still be the priority in dealing with Russia. And there again, she's taken the lead. She, like Putin, I don't believe they were acquainted, but they're both from East Germany. She was a younger academic and, in effect, a member of the communist regime because you had to be. He, of course, cut his teeth, very sharp and bloodstained teeth, working with the KGB. And the Stasi in East Germany, the very, very powerful and very ugly security force in East Germany. Mm. In some ways, a more pervasive security force in terms of the percentage of the population included than the Gestapo, the direct successors to the Gestapo working with the KGB from the Soviet Union. It was really a devil's pact, and Putin, I believe, really not only made his bones, but really started to advance professionally in that context.
In one of those articles you writing about Chancellor Merkel, you also spelled out the new leadership in Greece. And of course, this again comes at a time when their economy is in seems to be in free fall, or at least was there for a while. But you made mention of, I think you might have used the term odd couple to describe the new political coalition that, in effect, is running Greece. And apparently we're talking about two different maybe political parties or factions, but what unites them is their hostility towards European institutions and their hostility towards these austerity measures which are being forced on Greece. Could you talk more about this new leadership scheme in Greece? And
well, I can, but not much. I'm not the only reason I'm knowledgeable at all about contemporary Greece is because of the ongoing crisis. They have a relatively very heavy debt load, but it's a small economy. Two parties on the left and right have come together to form a new government, a major change in Greece, united by, as you indicate, hostility to the European Union. And there was a lot of trumpeting and emphasis on how Greece is a victim and Greece is taken advantage of, the usual debtor's complaints. It's not my fault. the usual convict's complaints. No, actually, I'm not guilty of anything.
Right.
In all kinds of contexts, that basic part of our human nature comes out. to actually answer your question, that's how they got elected. In fact, they've been far more moderate in dealing with the European Union. And after saying, no, no, we've got to have better conditions, and the Germans saying, you've got to pay up, according to the news early this morning, there is a four-month extension agreement put in place so the Greeks will continue to pay what the government is able to pay. They're not going to leave the European Union, nor do I think they will. Europe, unlike the U.S., has been in continuing severe recession overall, with a few bright spots. But governments still do have taxing authority, and as long as you're willing to negotiate the terms, from the convict to the banker doesn't want your house, he doesn't want your car, he doesn't want your wife and kids, the banker wants interest. and as long as you can satisfy the bankers that you'll still be paying something, the situation is manageable, and everybody has an interest, especially with Russia in Ukraine and elsewhere. And especially given the nature of Russian leadership, I think that's a very positive incentive for the Europeans to work together with the bear right next door.
Right. You really took aim at Standard & Poor's in one of your columns, talking about their agreement to pay, I think, more than $1 billion.
Real money.
Yeah, to settle federal fraud charges. I think this is the kind of thing that, you know, most of us who scarcely balance our own checkbooks, you know, really have a hard time following in terms of Standard & Poor's. We hear that term all the time, but, you know, it's even hard for the typical American to really know who that is and what they did, and in this case, what they did wrong. But you clearly believe they did something really wrong. I mean, they have conducted themselves in a way that really bothers you a lot.
There is a general consensus that credit ratings agencies are historically controversial, especially starting with the Great Depression. And with that background, the fact that they were, especially after the turn of this century, constant cheerleaders for financial institutions that were issuing increasingly risky financial derivatives based on more and more on the U.S. housing bubble, which finally collapsed and created a worldwide recession. That rightly led to a lot of criticism of them. And within the past couple of weeks, they settled with the Justice Department. I do know something about the details of this agreement because these op-eds appear in a range of newspapers around the country, and one of the editors did call me on the fact that the op-ed said they confessed to fraud, but the Justice Department did not bring criminal charges against them. They confessed to a variety of civil fraud that doesn't involve felony charges, but nonetheless is a violation of the law. They in effect, without confessing to that criminal activity, they agreed, without confessing guilt, to pay the Justice Department the enormous sum that you mention. I think, in effect, in reality, it is a confession of guilt, and showed the irresponsible role of not just Standard & Poor's, but other major credit ratings agencies in going along with this. They also, at about the same time Justice was bringing the charges, just about a year ago, they with the great flourish, lowered the credit rating of the federal government of the United States from AAA below, because the U.S. was the worst kind of hypocritical sanctimony from these people. The federal government must really get its house in order, or we will not be able to continue to give them any kind of decent rating. It's just so transparent. I think that maybe set me off more than anything.
Right.
But
so
that's the source of the Casablanca analogy.
Yeah,
in the article.
So, I mean, I think you end the article by saying they really need to engage in some aggressive self-reform, and they need to begin now.
No.
So how is it that you would, in what way, most importantly, would you want them to change the way they do what they do?
I think they should be more transparent, and I think they'll make money. They'll make more money over a longer period of time if they're not such obvious shills for Wall Street and are more transparent in more reliable and honest in doing what they're supposed to do, which is actually evaluate the credit ratings, the credit standing of private organizations and also financial instruments issued by the government. Mm. But the idea, as I mentioned in the article, that a government, especially the U.S. government, with enormous actual and potential assets can be compared to even the largest private corporation is frankly absurd. Mm. And indeed, as I mentioned in the article, and in line with the Casablanca era, right after World War II, when our debt load was much heavier than it is today, relatively speaking, although more manageable because they were wartime expenses. But the government had also undertaken, was in an uncharted territory, not only in foreign policy with World War II and then almost immediately the Cold War, but also unemployment insurance, the GI Bill, Social Security, programs that were unknown in terms of cost or impact on the government or on citizens. That was a far more uncertain time. S&P, of course, did not lower the credit rating of the federal government because to do so during a depression and war would have been a recipe for ostracism. Mm. Most people did not trust S&P at that time either. And it's clear when you look back at their reports of that era, they're cheerleaders for Wall Street. Stocks are constantly being described as undervalued. Buy stocks, put your money back in the market. In fact, stock prices did not reach 1929 levels until about 1954, which shows just how profound the impact of the Depression was. Wow. Also, bankers and financiers did go to jail in the 30s. Except for Bernie Madoff and a few really extreme renegades as well as crooks. The Obama and Bush administrations have not prosecuted financial executives with the same intensity and same hostility that was the case during the Depression.
Hmm. Fascinating situation.
Yeah. Well, I think it's more positive, actually. It shows that we're not involved in the kind of tremendous fear, you know, this pervasive fear itself and this tremendous hostility to capital, despite you referenced the fact that the rich are getting richer. We don't live in that kind of time anymore, and we're all better off for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in our last minute, do you want to say anything about NBC News anchor Brian Williams and his fall from grace and his six-month suspension without pay?
I think life is becoming more like a soap opera in some ways. Honesty is the best policy, but we are far more publicly moralistic. The Casablanca reference was to Captain Renault famously saying in the film, "I'm shocked to find gambling going on, absolutely shocked to see gambling going on in Rick's casino." I think there's a whiff of that with Brian Williams. Mm. Honesty is the best policy, especially if you're on a public stage, especially if you're a news person. I have no knowledge as to whether he was consciously exaggerating, or maybe he believed it. Hmm. When you're getting shot at, when you're in the eyes, figuratively or literally, we all have a tendency to, whether you realize it or not, exaggerate our own role, our own effectiveness. Who knows? I feel sorry for him at some level, although he's been getting $10 million a year for quite a while, so we don't have to feel too sorry.
Right. And on that note, we're going to finish up, but I sure appreciate yet another interesting and stimulating hour with you, Dr. Art Sear. It's always great to have you here, and look forward to seeing you back in March and April and May and all the months thereafter. Thank you so much for being an important part of the morning show.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Berg.
Good to have you here. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. We want to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio has begun its winter membership fund drive today, and your contributions to WGTD very concretely translate into support for WGTD in many different ways. And, of course, in the times in which we live and with significant budget cuts looming for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Wisconsin Public Radio, it's especially important, if you appreciate public radio, to indicate your support right now. Please take a moment to call 888 888- 202-2552, 888-202-2552. You can also pledge via the website, WPR.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and